On Debt, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Debt, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
China Lee Hunter is not used to thinking a lot about schoolwork when she's doing her retail job at the Adidas store. But last month, she couldn't help it. It's where she found out her AP African American Studies course was being banned.
I was at work, long story short, and I was on break and I was scrolling through Instagram and I saw it on someone's story. And I kind of just tapped through stories. But when I saw bands, I was like, well, let me go back.
China Lee is 17. She lives in Miami, Florida. It was Florida's governor, Ron DeSantis, who had decided to tinker with her course load. His administration said the pilot class she and a few other kids were taking lacked educational value.
I was literally like, there's no way that I'm literally taking that class. Like, there were so many thoughts that was going through my head. Like, I'm taking this class. What does this mean? Why are we going back in history?
This African American Studies class was a bit of an experiment. The Advanced Placement Program, which offers college-level courses to high school kids all around the country, had asked a few schools to try it out before they offered it nationwide. Although Florida's Department of Education did not seem to like what it saw, China Lee points out it's not like anyone asked her about it. If they had, she would have told them how much she loved the class. When I heard about this dust-up, I had so many questions. Like, what was it about this particular curriculum that offended Florida's educators so much that they stepped in mid-year? And for high schoolers like China Lee, was she just out a course credit? China Lee says that's not exactly how it worked. She's still taking the same subject. It's just been altered a bit.
We still have the same like plan set out. But like the articles that we were reading that were directly from like College Board, we're not allowed to read anymore. So for instance, like we've read a poem from a Black soldier on how he felt during the Civil War, on like how they didn't want Black soldiers fighting because one, they didn't want to kill their slaves, of course, because they were doing all the work for them, or just the fact that they didn't want to fight alongside someone that was Black. So having that like firsthand information is taken away from us. So now it's just vague instead of more personal.
While China Lee's teacher spent class time changing around her syllabus, China Lee and her friends decided to write letters to the governor. They have not worked up the nerve to send them in yet. So we asked China Lee to just tell us, what would she say to Governor DeSantis if she ran into him on the street?
Well, if I'm being rude, I would say, what is your problem? But I can't say that. So I would say, what makes you so uncomfortable with all of history? Or what makes you so uncomfortable with the truth of history? Literally, like, what makes you so uncomfortable?
Today on the show, public education is making a lot of politicians uncomfortable right now, and not just in Florida. It turns out that has implications for what all kids are learning. I'm Mary Harris. You're listening to What Next? Stick around.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
This episode is brought to you by Discover. When it comes to your finances, Discover wants you to know they are the credit card that is always there for you. With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, that means no more waiting for, quote, normal business hours just to get a hold of someone. We are talking real service from real people whenever you need it. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its authors' intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special 2-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
Like a lot of people, I heard about the fight over African-American studies in Florida, and I thought, well, that sounds like Ron DeSantis being Ron DeSantis. After all, Florida's governor has made education into a major talking point, rejecting any historical information his administration thinks might make America's children feel bad about themselves and their country. But I called up Jeremy Young, a historian at Penn America, because he says what happened with his AP class is actually an indication of something bigger that's going on in public education. It's just that this larger conflict is most clearly visible in Florida with something like this advanced placement stunt. So I asked him to start at the beginning. He said he first heard about the AP program offering African American studies a few months back, and at the time, he was optimistic about it.
It sounded like a really exciting new departure for the advanced placement program, which often focuses on courses that are universally offered in college core curricula, U.S. history, early mathematics courses, English literature, things of that sort.
You're saying advanced placement's a little basic sometimes.
Well, yes, because they want to make sure that the courses are going to be accepted and needed in every college in the country when they are transferred.
Right.
And to include African American studies, it's an acknowledgement of the fundamental importance of the field. Absolutely.
So when did it become clear that things in Florida weren't going so great for this AP African American history course?
You know, it was in some ways it wasn't shocking given other things that have happened in Florida around education in the recent past, but there was not any public warning that there was going to be an attack on this AP course or a rejection of this AP course until it was rejected. You know, there was an article in the National Review quoting a letter from the State Department of Education declaring that the course, you know, was not teaching legitimate history or content.
Yeah, this was a letter from Manny Diaz, the commissioner of education in Florida, right?
Right, from Manny Diaz. And the AP received it. And that was the first that this was publicly known that this was going to happen.
Yeah, what was interesting to me about that letter from Diaz is that he cited specific academics in it. He called out Kimberly Crenshaw, who people may be familiar with. Some people say that she was one of the people to name critical race theory. He calls out Bell Hooks, who is a poet, feminist, Black scholar. You know, I know who some of these people are. I wonder, like, is the inclusion of these thinkers some kind of indoctrination, in your opinion?
The first thing to understand about this is that this is an African-American studies course, not an African-American history course. So the state is assuming that, you know, some sort of pantheon of famous political figures or celebrities in African-American history is what this course should be teaching. That's not it at all. Hmm. African-American studies is an interdisciplinary field that draws on history, literature, fine and performing arts, sociology, and other cultural studies fields. And it also has its own distinct methodology. And these two figures, Kimberly Crenshaw, who coined the term and the concept of intersectionality, and Bell Hooks, the noted African-American feminist writer, these are two of the towering figures in the field of African-American studies. And to learn African-American studies is to survey the thought of prominent African-American thinkers, among other things. And you simply cannot do that without including thinkers from all aspects of the spectrum and from all aspects of the field.
Yeah, it didn't really surprise me that Ron DeSantis and his administration were picking a fight over this class. But it did surprise me what happened next, which is the College Board announcing that they were going to upend their curriculum, and not just in Florida, for everyone. Did that move surprise you?
Not really. And I should know that the College Board thinks has said that publicly that they did not make any changes to the curriculum on the basis of the governor's comments.
They just happened to do it right around the same time.
Well, so I think there's some truth to this. I think there's truth in two ways. First, it is true that these are dense readings, as the College Board has claimed, that some students may find them difficult. But it beggars belief that they truly intended to eliminate all of the content areas that these readings focus on, because they have done that. They have eliminated the unit on queer theory. They have eliminated the unit on Black Lives Matter, not just the readings, but the entire unit. The other way that there's truth to their comment is, you know, this course was being criticized by conservative commentators, by pundits, and perhaps by local figures as well, while it was being piloted before the governor got to it. So it is quite possible that the College Board made this capitulation to these other critics before the governor jumped on the bandwagon.
Because they saw the writing on the wall.
And the College Board has a history of doing whatever it needs to maintain its status as an accepted option in all 50 states.
It turns out that before this back and forth over African-American studies, the advanced placement program twisted itself in knots over U.S. history. This was back in 2014. Conservatives complained the course was not pro-American enough. Some states, like Oklahoma, considered rejecting the class entirely.
And ultimately, the College Board responded to that criticism by adding a unit on American exceptionalism, which said only positive things about American history and culture.
Whoa.
So the College Board has never been shy about being willing to defend its position in these states, really almost no matter what, you know, capitulation they have to do to make that happen.
Yeah, I mean, when I read a bit about this decision in 2014, 2015, about the U.S. history course, it was interesting to me how explicit the changes were about race. Like, one change that one person noted was that, you know, the 2014 version, the original version of this history course, talked about manifest destiny, the idea that, you know, white settlers in the United States should move west, that it was, you know, part of their mission to do that, that, you know, this was about cultural superiority. That, you know, originally this course said this was about white people making this decision to move west inside North America, and it was about cultural superiority among white people. But then when the curriculum was published, they got rid of the white aspect.
It always surprises me when critics of these curricula want to take the explicit mention of race out of these courses, because if you look at the historical documents, and I'm a U.S. historian by training, if you look at the historical documents from these periods, the white historical figures who were promoting concepts like Manifest Destiny were very open about the fact that they were doing it to promote what they would call the white race. You know, you can find innumerable quotes from senators and governors and even presidents making exactly this argument. They weren't shy about it. It's not something that's being inserted later by historians. And yet there seems to be this squeamishness around talking about that fact when we talk about American history.
I think the College Board censoring itself is so important here, because when I dug in, and I think this was some of your writing, where you noted that when states have tried to ban things like ethnic studies in the past, like Arizona tried to do this, there have been court rulings saying you can't do that. That's racist. That's motivated by racial animus. That's not allowed. And so a ban, like what Ron DeSantis was doing, you can potentially challenge that in court and flip it around. But if the College Board is censoring itself and responding to criticism and sort of watering down the curriculum, you don't get that opportunity to have that conversation and have a ruling on the other end.
That's exactly right. And, you know, that is the way that this educational censorship has tended to work. When a law censors content in a classroom, or when an elected official censors a course, as we've seen in this case, what happens is that the law is only infrequently enforced directly. We have seen some instances where some of these censorship laws have been enforced and have resulted in punishments for school districts or for teachers, but it's rare. What tends to happen instead is that the law creates a chilling effect on speech. The law, because of its vagueness, because it's so unclear to teachers, to administrators, what exactly is being banned and why it's being banned, it leads them, out of an abundance of caution and the prudent management of risk, to censor themselves, and in the case of administrators, to censor the teachers who they supervise. And so it's not surprising to see the College Board fall prey to the same trap that many teachers are having to deal with.
Jeremy Young wrote a whole report about these censorship laws last year. He calls them educational gag orders. These laws ban certain concepts like so-called critical race theory, and they allow parents to sue if they feel a school is in violation of them. Jeremy's only found a few examples of parents or other interested parties bringing a school to court for what's going on in the classroom. But he worries that it doesn't take a whole lot of legal action for these rules to have a chilling effect.
So the ultimate outcome of this is to silence teachers and silence classrooms.
And there was a RAND report recently that came out that kind of boosted this, because it surveyed thousands of teachers and principals and basically echoed this finding, said that, you know, teachers feel like they need to hold themselves back, and especially Black teachers, I guess because they feel more vulnerable. I'm not sure.
That's absolutely right. The survey from the RAND Corporation found that over a quarter of teachers are self-censoring or being told to censor their content. The numbers are higher among social studies teachers, and they are higher among Black or African-American teachers in states that have passed educational gag order laws. There are 17 states where that's the case.
So your state doesn't even need to have passed a gag order for the teachers to be censoring themselves. It just needs to be like in the ether the way it is. But then it's worse if you're somewhere where there is a law.
That's right. And there was a remarkable quote in this report where a teacher said, the state told us that we had to ban, we couldn't teach critical race theory. And none of us were. But now I'm afraid to teach Frederick Douglass because I don't think the people in my community know the difference between Black history and critical race theory.
Oof.
That's just a heartbreaking comment. And I think it really underscores the real effect of these laws, which is not to ban this concept that you know is not being taught in K-12 classrooms, but instead to silence all sorts of teaching about African-American history, slavery, racism, and gender and sexuality.
Something that stood out to me about the RAND report that we talked about, that survey of teachers, is that One of the things they asked in this survey was about whether teachers and principals thought structural racism existed. And a healthy majority of teachers and principals did think structural racism existed. And that stood out to me because I think that's something that the Ron DeSantis's of the world would strongly disagree with. And so in a way, I look at this fight over education and I think, well, Ron DeSantis and folks like him may have identified people that they truly do disagree with here. It's just that he's using his power as an executive to completely stifle them instead of engaging them.
I think you're right. And the problem here is not that people disagree about whether structural racism exists. The problem is that there are people in this conversation who want to ban any viewpoints on this question other than their own from being taught in a school. And that's wrong. That's censorship. That's, you know, plain and simple. There's no there's nothing more censorious than the government telling teachers that they cannot teach a particular interpretation that has scholarly support, that has a certain amount of support within public opinion, because a particular elected official disagrees with it.
After the break, the next front in this war over education is public universities. Turns out Florida's leading the way there, too.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
Jeremy Young says Florida's war over education is now spilling over to higher ed. Last month, Governor DeSantis proposed a slate of legislation putting new restrictions on public colleges and universities. These laws would give the state more control both over what gets taught at state schools and who gets hired there, deprioritizing majors deemed to have a political agenda. They'd also make it easier to get rid of faculty tenure. The state would be able to tinker with a university mission statement and forbid the use of school funds to support any activities related to diversity and inclusion or critical race theory. Jeremy has called these proposed rules the most draconian restrictions on public higher education institutions in the U.S.
And in fact, I might even go farther than that. It's possible, although we haven't seen the legislative text yet, that these proposals, when introduced and or adopted, would be the most draconian restrictions on higher education in American history.
Whoa.
These previous laws that we've been talking about, they restrict classroom instruction. What the governor has proposed goes beyond that level of censorship to censor entire institutions and to take away the autonomy of higher education, of public higher education institutions.
You know, the rhetoric that's used in changing curriculum and banning books for K through 12 students, it's often about parental rights and topics being too complicated for kids. What is the reasoning for these kinds of changes in higher education, where you're looking at adults who are being educated?
Well, we have occasionally seen the parental rights argument even in higher education. There was a case a few months ago at Valdosta State University in Georgia where a parent complained to a dean about a biology lecture on gender, and said that, you know, as a parent, you know, he didn't want his tuition dollars going to pay for this lecture, and the dean shut the lecture down. It's a horrible case, but it is rare, at least for now. So primarily, the argument that's being made is that these students are being indoctrinated by their liberal professors. Even though they're adults, they're being fed a bill of goods. They're being fed information that is one-sided, that is unfair, and essentially being shaped to hate America. Now, this is completely false in a number of ways. For one thing, there have been a number of excellent studies, including a study that just came out this week in the University of Wisconsin system, demonstrating that conservative students do not particularly feel indoctrinated by their liberal teachers, that when they do feel uncomfortable, it is usually with their liberal peers, and it's usually outside of class, which does, of course, suggest there's a problem, but that problem doesn't really have much to do with the faculty. It has to do with the campus culture and climate, which is more of a university staff or administrative issue.
And it's not just Florida, right? Like, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick in Texas is, you know, urging the legislature to end tenure for university hires sort of in a similar way to what's happening here. Like, this is something that may go beyond Ron DeSantis.
Yes, I think everyone is waiting to see what the legislative text will look like, but I would not be surprised at all to see these proposals. First of all, I think they will pass in Florida. I think they will be introduced in other states, and they will pass in some other states as well. And it's important for advocates of free expression and of higher education to realize that there is a window right now to lay the groundwork to combat these proposals in other states. But the groundwork has to be laid now, because otherwise we are looking at an America that is split between states that allow free and open education in the higher education sphere and states that don't, states that are that where higher education is run by political operatives and politically appointed figures or elected figures, and that bans, outright bans, departments, majors, and ideas that those leaders don't like. And to have politicians and government authorities writing college mission statements, deciding what college majors should be prioritized and deprioritized, you know, closing departments, that is the end of higher education as we know it. You know, studies have shown that students tend not to change their opinions to become more liberal just because they attend college or more conservative, that they, you know, essentially don't really change their views very much in college at all. Instead, what they do is they become more aware and understanding and tolerant of people who have views different from theirs. So the goal of exposing them to these ideas is not to change how they think. It's to change how they understand others and how much they can identify with other people. It's to teach empathy, intellectual empathy.
I'm so glad you said that, because I feel like part of the problem I see with this effort to stifle what topics are allowed on public college campuses is that it runs the risk of deepening divides in this country. And I say that because if the only place you can learn about critical race theory is some expensive elite institution, it's going to warp the way whole pockets of the country understand themselves and each other.
That's absolutely true. College is one of the last bastions of free expression in this country. It is one of the only places that you can go and meet many people who think differently from you, who have different backgrounds from you, who have different experiences from you, and encounter them on an equal footing in an environment of free inquiry and knowledge. And without that ability, which is exactly what is being attacked here, what is being targeted here, without that ability to learn from one another and to communicate with one another openly, we will simply sink further and further into our partisan divides, and we will know less and less about each other. So ultimately, this is an attack not just on colleges, not just on free expression, but on democracy itself. Because the people who are being denied this education in higher education right now are the people who are going to grow up and become voters and leaders and determine the future of our society. And if they lack the ability to understand people different from themselves, they will make different decisions from the decisions they would have otherwise made.
Jeremy, thanks for coming on the show. I'm really grateful for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jeremy Young is the Senior Manager of Free Expression and Education at PEN America. China Lee Hunter, who you heard from at the top of the show, she's a senior at Robert Morgan Educational Center in Miami, Florida. And that's the show. If you're a fan of what we're doing here at What Next, the best way to support us is to go on over to slate.com/whatnextplus and investigate our membership program. It has all kinds of benefits. Go check it out. What Next is produced by Elena Schwartz, Carmel Delshad, and Madeline Ducharme. We are getting a ton of support from Anna Phillips, Jared Downing, and Laura Spencer. It was Madeline and Laura who set up that conversation with China Lee Hunter you heard at the top of the show. Thanks, you guys. We are led by Alicia Montgomery with a little help from Susan Matthews. Ben Richmond is the Senior Director of Podcast Operations here at Slate. And I'm Mary Harris. I'm handing the reins over to Lizzie O'Leary right now. She'll be here with What Next TBD for the next few days. And I'll be back in this feed on Monday. Catch you then.